enough understanding about special relativity and the nature of space and time to be able to do that. And this is a wonderful topic today called Einstein's Rotating Disk Thought Experiment. So some of you may know that Einstein was famous for his thought experiments. And this was a particularly important one, which played a significant role in him bridging the gap between special relativity and general relativity and putting him on the right road towards general relativity. So let's see how this works. Okay, so Einstein's rotating disk thought experiment. Okay, where's our white chalk? Okay, so here's the situation. So we got a space station here, which is floating above the surface of the Earth. And inside, we got Bob, and Bob is weightless, just like the astronauts in the space shuttle. Okay, so there he is, floating around weightless. Should we talk a little bit about weightlessness? Do you want to talk about a little bit about weightlessness? Okay, just very quickly here. So this is a famous thought experiment much earlier by Newton, where he discovered a really clear way of thinking about how objects orbit around, say, the Earth. So for example, the moon or in modern times, satellites and so on. Okay, so here we've got the Earth, and here we've got a tall mountain like this, and we're standing on top of this tall mountain, and we're going to throw objects horizontally. Okay, so first we throw it just lightly, horizontally. So the trajectory is going to go first horizontally, and then it's going to drop down like this, clunk, and it's going to hit beside the base of the mountain. Okay, if we throw it harder, then it's going to go a bit further, and it's going to go boonk down like that. If we throw it yet harder, it's going to maybe go that far, and so on. So this is a process of generalization. Okay, you start with one simple case, and you just try to push it further and further and further and see what happens. Okay, and so eventually, you know, you imagine it might do this and hit the Earth over here. Okay, so if I throw it hard enough, well, if I throw it super hard, what's going to happen is what? It's just going to basically go almost on a straight line like this, and it's just going to go out and never come back. Okay, so there's something in between throwing it lightly and throwing it really hard, so it never comes back, whereby if you throw it just hard enough, it's going to go out like this. So Newton realized that it must just go out like this and come in a circle and bang, hit him in the back of the head. Okay, and so if he moves his head aside, then it's going to go whizzing by his head, and it's going to go around and around and around. Okay, so that's just one object. Okay, that's like a satellite, or you throw a rock, or that's like the moon, that sort of thing. Now, what if you threw two objects, two rocks? You threw them basically at the same time. You threw them together, like this, like that. Okay, and so they come whipping around like this. The two of them, so here's these two, so at any point here, we've got these two rocks floating in space. They're basically on the same trajectory, just side by side. And if you're standing on one of these rocks and someone's standing on the other rock, you're basically just floating in space relative to each other. Okay, and so that's what's happening with Bob and the space station. Okay, so Bob is like one rock orbiting around the Earth, and the space station is like another rock orbiting around the Earth that are just next to each other. Okay, and so they're just hovering, they're just floating next to each other. Okay, so they're still in the gravitational field. Okay, both of them still, the Earth's gravitational field doesn't end up here. I mean, it continues like a 1 over r squared out forever, right? So they're still in the gravitational field, but they're weightless. Okay, there's that sense of weightlessness. Okay, they're on essentially the same trajectory. Okay, so now Bob here is is this, you know, engineer guy, and he's supposed to be doing useful things on the space shuttle, you know, useful experiments and constructing things and whatever he's supposed to be doing up there. And he can't very well do that if he's like floating around like weightless and stuff. So what we want to do is introduce an artificial gravitational field. How are we going to do that? spin. We're going to spin this guy. Excellent. Okay. So we're going to spin this guy at some rotation rate omega, and we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so everyone, how many of you have been on that amusement park ride, which is this great big cylinder, which is spinning around, and it's got this floor? And so as you're spinning around, so your back is to the wall like this, and you're whipping around like this, and then it feels like you're being pushed against the back of the wall like this, and then friction and all that stuff, and then they can drop the floor out on you. Yeah, this thing is fantastic. And then it actually turns upwards like this, and you're going around like that. I love that kind of thing. Anyways, so that's what's happening here. So we're going to create this artificial gravitational field by rotating. And how many of you have seen that old movie, Stanley Kubrick, 2001, A Space Odyssey? Yeah! Okay. And also, this kind of very, very simple technology might be used to get people on a trip to Mars. Okay? Because being weightless for a long period of time, what happens is your bones degenerate and all kinds of bad things happen to the human body. So the whole idea is to keep people in some kind of a gravitational field similar to that on the Earth. And you can do that by just rotating the spaceship. Okay, so the first thing I want you to be convinced of is the idea that... Okay, we'll just forget about the Earth and all that stuff, and we'll just focus on Bob and the space station here, rotating space station or spacecraft. So what we were talking about for the amusement ride is Bob basically lying on his back. He feels like he's being pressed against the wall, okay? And he's whipping around like this, around and around. Okay, now I want you to be convinced that Bob could also just stand up. Okay, so if Bob could stand up so that the inner surface of that cylinder is now his floor. Okay, his arms would feel heavy, and they would drop down like this, and he would be able to work at his little workstation and do stuff in his artificial gravitational field, and so now he's very happy. Okay, so how many of you are okay with that? Is that all right? Okay, so from Bob's point of view, he would consider this to be up. So the direction toward the central axis of the cylinder is up, and the direction towards the floor is down. Okay, so the gravitation, this artificial gravitational field, defines up and down for him, just like the real gravitational field on the Earth defines up and down for us. Okay, so we got that. So now the question we have is, we've got Bob in something which seems like a gravitational field, it's an artificial gravitational field, and the question is, how closely does that artificial gravitational field mimic the real gravitational field that would be produced by a mass, like the Earth or the Sun or a galaxy, that kind of thing. Okay, so how close is artificial to real? Okay. All right, so whenever I say real gravity, I mean that gravity due to masses. Whenever I say artificial gravity, I mean that gravity due to motion, okay, acceleration. Okay, so one experiment that we could do is Bob could hold on to an apple in his hand here. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a top-down view, looking down the axis of the cylinder and seeing Bob going around and around like this. Okay, and we're going to analyze the situation of him holding on to that apple. Okay, so let's suppose that Bob is over here. And he's holding on to an apple like that. Okay? What is the motion of the apple? This guy is spinning. The whole space station and Bob, who's holding on to the apple, are spinning around. What is the motion of the apple? Right. So the shape of the orbit of the apple is moving in circular motion, uniform circular motion. Okay, so here's the apple. It's moving around in uniform circular motion. Okay, so what is required to put something in uniform circular motion? How do you get something moving in uniform circular motion? Yeah, so uniform circular motion means there's an acceleration directed towards the center. So as soon as there's an acceleration, there's a force. Okay, so in order for this apple to be moving in this uniform circular motion, requires that there be a force acting on that apple, and that force be directed toward the center. Okay, so there's a center-directed force. Where's that force coming from? Sorry? Normal reaction? Yeah, so the hand. So Bob is exerting that force. That's where that force is coming from, right? So let's see if here's the situation. From Bob's point of view, what Bob notices is I'm standing in this thing. I actually maybe don't even know that I'm rotating. Okay, I'm just standing inside this thing. It's a sealed container, a sealed cylinder. I don't have any windows to the outside. I can't see the distant stars like this. And I can't see that I'm rotating relative to the distant stars. I just feel this weird kind of artificial gravitation, maybe not real. I feel this artificial gravitational field. I'm hanging onto an apple like this in my hand, and I notice that in this state of whatever is happening in this state, I feel like I'm pushing up on this apple. Okay, so I'm exerting an upward force on this apple. Okay, so that's exactly the same as Bob standing on the surface of the Earth. Okay, I'm standing on the surface of the Earth here, and to hold this piece of chalk, I have to keep pushing up on this piece of chalk. So I'm exerting this upward force. Okay, so far so good. So with this simple experiment, Bob wouldn't be able to distinguish between whether he's inside this rotating space station or whether he's on the surface of the Earth holding this apple. In both cases, it's phenomenologically the same. He's exerting an upward force. Okay, what if Bob releases the apple? What if Bob just drops it like this? What if he removes his hand? So this apple is whipping, so Bob and the apple are whipping around and around and around and around like this. And then suddenly, at this instant of time over here, Bob releases the apple. What's going to happen to the trajectory of the apple? Okay, it's going to move exactly tangentially to the circle. So whatever the velocity the apple had at the instant that Bob released it, it would maintain that velocity. There's now no more force acting. The acceleration stops. The velocity remains constant. It remains exactly what it was at the instant it was released. And so what will happen is the trajectory of the apple will change from a circle to just a straight line, okay? Just floating freely in space. This is just empty space. You release an apple from that point with that velocity. It just travels on a straight line like that, okay? But now, while this apple is traveling on this straight line, during that time, Bob is also still moving around, right? So by the time the apple hits the inside wall at this point, Bob will have turned around. Bob himself will have turned around so that now he's standing over here. Okay, and you'll notice that the apple hits the what Bob considers to be the ground, hits the ground right at Bob's feet. Okay, so let's see if that's the same. So here on the Earth, we got Bob. He releases the apple like this, and what happens is it just goes clunk and it hits the floor. Moreover, it accelerates toward the floor. So as it's falling, it's picking up speed faster and faster and faster. Okay, and that's actually what's happening here. So if you notice, let me just use a different color chalk so we don't get too messy here. You'll notice that initially, the initial velocity, just the instant that Bob releases the apple, the initial velocity of the apple is like this. The initial velocity of Bob is exactly the same. Okay, so the apple and Bob have exactly the same velocity vectors. What is their relative velocity? Zero. The difference of the two velocities is zero. Okay, so as far as Bob is concerned, when he releases it, for a split second, it just has zero velocity. It's just hovering there for a split second. Okay, but then as time goes on, you'll notice that the distance between Bob's feet here and the apple gets less and less and less. Okay, the apple is not accelerating. The apple is moving on a straight line, but the floor is moving on this curved trajectory. The floor is accelerating. In fact, the floor is accelerating up toward the apple. So at this instant of time, the apple and the floor are on parallel courses, okay, and there's very little relative velocity. But by the time the apple gets over here, the floor has bent around like this and accelerated upward, and it's going slam. It's accelerating up and hitting the apple. Okay? So you can see just from this picture that the relative velocity between the apple and the floor is going to be increasing as the apple approaches the floor, which is exactly what we see here. Okay? It starts off falling slowly, picks up speed faster and faster and faster, and then it hits the floor. Okay? So far, so good. So with these two simple experiments, Bob can't distinguish between whether he's in this rotating cylinder out floating out in space, or whether he's just standing on the surface of the Earth. Okay? And for all of these things, what we're going to imagine, actually, I'm sort of exaggerating the situation here, what we're going to be imagining is that the space station is rather large compared to Bob. So Bob is actually down here. Okay, so the space station is rotating like this, and Bob and his apples and all that stuff are just this really small, on a small scale compared to the entire space station. Okay? So at least these two simple experiments indicate that this artificial gravitational field very well mimics the experiences one would have in a real gravitational field on the surface of the Earth. Okay, so are there any other tests that we could do to see how well this artificial gravitational field mimics a real gravitational field? You could throw it up. Okay, so he could toss it like this, see what happens. Okay, so it would go like that, and he would go like that. And is that a parabolic trajectory? I don't know. Okay, what other tests? What about a weigh scale? What if he had a weigh scale? A weigh scale is like a spring scale like this. You stand on that scale and you determine your weight. Would a weigh scale work the same in this rotating space station artificial gravitational field as on the Earth? What about a balance scale? So a balance scale is like this. And you stick a mass there and you stick a mass there and you adjust their whatever until it's balanced. Would that work the same? Okay, so I encourage you to sit back later on and think about this and come up with different tests that you could do to try to distinguish between this and this. Okay? Anyways, so as far as it goes, as far as we've said so far, it certainly looks like the artificial gravitational field mimics a real gravitational field quite well. So why is this significant? Well, here comes Einstein. Okay, so first of all, Einstein realized, this is after special relativity, after Einstein has realized there's a universal speed limit, and he's understood time dilation, length contraction, and all that stuff, relativity of simultaneity, he starts turning his attention to gravity. Okay? And he recognizes that Newton's model of gravity, Newton's picture of gravity, the mental construct that Newton made to try to make sense of this phenomenon called gravity, must be wrong. Okay, and there are two main reasons, two simple sort of ways to think about this. One reason is theoretical, and the other is experimental. So the theoretical reason has to do with what I just said, that there's this universal speed limit. Okay, so all physical phenomena respect the fact that information of any kind cannot be transmitted from point A to point B faster than the speed of light. Okay, so now, Newton's model of gravity does not respect this. Newton's model of gravity doesn't have anything to do with time in it. Newton's model of gravity is an action at a distance, an instantaneous action at a distance. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is, suppose that you've got the sun here, and we've got the Earth going around the sun. Okay, and according to Newtonian gravity, the Earth exerts a force on the sun, and vice versa. And the force that the Earth exerts on the sun is precisely that that center-directed or centripetal force required for the Earth to be in circular motion. Okay, that's Newton's model of gravity. Okay, now the problem with that is the force, according to Newton, the force that the sun exerts on the Earth depends upon the instantaneous positions of these two guys, okay, at the same instant. Okay? Now remember relativity of simultaneity. When you say that these two events are happening simultaneously, well, simultaneous for who? Okay? So right away, there's going to be a bit of a problem, you can see. But a simpler way to see that is, let's suppose that at one instant of time, the sun suddenly disappears. So we're a magician, and we can make the sun magically disappear. Okay, so at some specific, so here's the Earth wheeling around in its orbit here. And at this particular instant of time, when it's at this position, we suddenly remove the sun. What's going to happen, according to Newton's model of gravity, to the trajectory of the Earth? Right. The instant that we've removed the sun, according to Newton's model of gravity, the gravitational force is instantly gone. Because the gravitational force is g times m, the two masses, divided by r squared. There's no issue of time here. Okay? This is this r here is the instantaneous distance, et cetera. Okay? As soon as we pull this guy out, this force disappears. No more center-directed force. Just like the apple in the space station, bang, it takes off on this trajectory. And we would know instantly that that had happened. Because we'd look at the stars and we would say, hey, our motion relative to stars has changed exactly at that instant. Okay, so instantly this happens. But so what that means is we would have knowledge that the sun had disappeared instantly. Something happened over here and we instantly knew about it. Somehow information had made its way from here to here across this vast distance instantly. Okay, that's not possible if there's a speed limit in the universe. Okay, so what should happen, according to Einstein's reasoning, is if the sun were to disappear, then just like light, how long does it take light to get from the sun to the Earth? 8 minutes. Okay, so if a magician were to suddenly make the sun disappear, then the waves of light that were on their way to the Earth, you make the sun disappear, it's not going to make those waves disappear. Those waves would continue coming like this. Okay? And so for a full 8 minutes, we would be looking up at the sky, and we'd say, yeah, the sun's still there. Phew, that's a good thing. Okay? And then suddenly these waves would end, and we would say, 8 minutes later, we would say, whoa, something really bad has happened to us. We're in trouble. Okay? So light respects that speed limit. But gravity doesn't. What Einstein figured should happen is we've got the sun like this. Okay, the sun disappears at this instant in the orbit, and the Earth should continue on in exactly the same orbit for another 8 minutes before it suddenly realizes, whoa, the sun is gone, and then it goes off on a straight line. Okay, so there's an obvious reason why Newton's model of gravity must be wrong. It needs some kind of fixing. Okay. The second reason is experimental. Okay, and this has to do with the motions of the planets. So well before 1905 or 7 and so on, when Einstein is thinking about this, it was a well-known problem that Newton's model of gravity was running into difficulty explaining the trajectories or the orbits of the planets, in particular Mercury. Okay, so the picture is something like this. Here is Mercury's orbit. It's basically an ellipse, right, around the sun. Okay, so by an ellipse, what that means is it starts off at this point, and it comes around, and it's a closed trajectory. So according to Newton's model of gravity, if you just have these masses here, and you use this Newtonian gravitational force and F equals ma and so on and so forth, it tells you that the planet Mercury should orbit on this closed ellipse like this. Okay, but when you actually take your telescope out and look at Mercury, you see that it doesn't do that. It does something very different, okay, or slightly different. What it does is it goes almost on an ellipse, okay, almost a perfect ellipse, but it returns to a slightly different point, okay, and then it takes off again and returns to a slightly different point. Okay, so its orbit actually looks something like this. So it's like a spirograph kind of thing. How many of you have ever done spirograph? OK, Couple of you? Excellent. Spirograph. Okay. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Now, the fact is, so this is called the precession of the perihelion, or the aphelion. This is the aphelion, so the precession, but it's usually called precession of the perihelion. Okay, so anyways, the line that connects the sun to the most distant point, that line at some instant of time maybe points to this star over here. Okay, but as time goes on, the line of the major axis of the ellipse ends up pointing to a different star over there. So this axis precesses. Okay. Now the thing is, you can within Newton's model of gravity, you can actually account for some of this precession. Okay. In fact, quite a lot of this precession by the presence of the other planets. So yeah, if the solar system consisted of just the sun and Mercury, then Newton's gravity says yes, a perfect ellipse, closed curve. But if we account for the other planets, such as Venus, and so here's Venus over here, and here's Jupiter over here. These guys all exert gravitational tugs on Mercury, according to Newton's model of gravity. And that's going to disturb the orbit. And it turns out that if you account for all of the planets, then the disturbance they produce actually does this. Okay? But the amount of disturbance is not quite right. If you account for all the planets very, very carefully, you will find that the amount of disturbance in, say, one century should be the major axis should precess from here all the way over to here. Okay, but how much it actually precesses is from here all the way over to here. And there's a small discrepancy. And this discrepancy was unexplained, okay, at the time. And then Einstein came, just to make the story short, Einstein came along, developed general relativity, a new model of gravity, which actually accounted precisely, dramatically precisely, for that slight discrepancy. Okay? So that's that. So Einstein needs a new model of gravity. Okay, but where's he going to start? How do you come up with a model of gravity? Yeah.
It's too difficult. What is the space that remains?
Oh, so this space is, so the amount of the discrepancy is 43 arc seconds per century. Okay, and an arc second is, so you have 360 degrees, and then if you take 1/60th of that, 1/60th of 1 degree, that's 1 arc minute. 1/60th again is 1 arc second. So it's 3,600th of a degree. So it's a very, very small fraction of a degree. So if you were to sit there for 100 years and watch Mercury going around and around and around, you would notice a discrepancy that's like super tiny. But nevertheless, the technology by the, I think it was the 1870s or so, was sufficiently developed, the observational technology, that you could actually, this was a definite problem. The technology was easily able to see this discrepancy.
Yes.
Sorry, that wasn't the right question. I didn't answer the right question. Okay, sorry.
Is it possible to that you tell us what is the cause of this?
What is the cause of this?
Yeah.
So one way to think about it is the Newton's model of gravity, the force is a 1 over r squared. So here it is. That's the 1 over r squared. If you look at the geometry, space-time geometry surrounding a spherically symmetric object, that space-time geometry it has a name. It's called the Schwarzschild geometry. And if you take a slice, of space passing through the equator of that massive object, maybe it's the sun or the earth or whatever, and you look at the geometry in that surface, the geometry is. The geometry is warped, and I'm going to be talking about this kind of warping a little bit later on, so I don't want to get into a lot of detail. The geometry is warped, okay? And so Einstein's model of gravity is a purely geometrical theory, but you can put it into kind of a Newtonian form, and if you put it into a Newtonian form, you find that it looks like a force that's 1 over r squared plus a small 1 over r cubed correction, okay? And this 1 over r cubed correction is what makes the orbit not close. Okay, you get closed orbits for precisely 1 over r squared forces and forces proportional to r. Proportional to either r or 1 over r squared. But anything other than that, you'll get non-closed orbits. And so this disturbs that a tiny bit, and you get slightly non-closed orbits. Okay, so we need this new theory of gravity. So where do we begin? How do we come up with a theory of gravity? Okay, so this is where the genius of Einstein and his thought experiments come in. Okay, so the idea here is Einstein already knows about special relativity. He has a great deal of experience with space and time and a great depth of understanding of it. And so what he says is, well, look at this situation here mimics a real gravitational field. Okay, this is this artificial gravitational field. So let's look at this artificial gravitational field in great detail, okay, and try to see whether we could learn something about a real gravitational field. Okay. So the idea then is, analyze artificial gravitational field for hints about real gravitational field. So you'll notice that Bob is inside the space station, and he's on some trajectory. He's moving through space in some way, but of course he's also moving through time. Okay, so if we draw some space-time diagram of this, this is x, y. So here's Bob's motion in space. He's just going around in a circle like this. But as time evolves here, okay, his trajectory is actually that, like that sort of thing. Okay? So he's on some trajectory, and we know all about space-time. Here's Bob on some accelerated trajectory in space-time. We should be able to account for the rate at which time goes, distance measurements, and all that kind of stuff. Okay? So let's analyze this situation in the context of special relativity very carefully and see if it offers any hints to what real gravity is about. Okay? So that's absolutely brilliant, and it was hugely successful. Okay, so here we go. So this was just, I mean, there were many other things, of course. I mean, I don't know what's in Einstein's mind. But there were many other things going on. But this was one of the things which was helpful in putting him on the right track. Okay? Understanding that gravity has something to do with the geometry of space-time. Okay, so the first special relativistic effect that we'll look at in this context is time dilation. Okay, so let's suppose that we've got Bob inside the space station, whipping around like this, and we've got a bunch of Alices outside who are at rest, who are not accelerated, who are just floating outside. Okay, so the picture looks like this. So I'm drawing a portion. I'm taking a top view down inside the cylinder. I'm drawing a portion of the cylinder here. Okay, and so here is Bob at one instant of time here, and Bob is moving with some velocity as he's whipping around, and around and around. Okay, and Alice, we've got two Alices floating out here. So here's one Alice who's not accelerating, and here's a second Alice over here, Alice prime, okay, who's also not accelerating. These two guys are at rest with respect to each other, just floating there. And Bob whips by them like this with a velocity v. Okay, so now the question is, when a certain amount of time, so and these guys have synchronized their clocks using our clock synchronization procedure. They send a light signal from here to here, back, reflects back, divide the time by 2, yada, yada. Okay, so when a certain amount of time, delta t, elapses for Alice and Alice prime, how much time will they have seen elapse on Bob's clock? Bob's got a wristwatch like this. So there's a little window. Alice and Alice prime can look in, and they see Bob's watch as it whips by. Okay, and so they see Bob's watch. Alice sees Bob's watch when it whips by her. Alice prime sees Bob's watch when he whips by her. Okay, what is the amount of time elapsed on Bob's clock relative to the amount of time elapsed on the Alice's clocks? What is the relationship between delta TB and delta TA? Does less time or more time elapse for Bob? Less. How much less? What's the formula?
Square
Okay, so it's less. Okay, so there's time dilation happening. Time is moving more slowly for Bob inside this rotating space station than for the Alice's outside. Okay, and oh, one thing I forgot to do. I wanted to write this down as well. So let's actually work out something here. A useful little relationship that's going to be that we're going to need. Okay, so in this rotating space station, what is, like here on the Earth, the acceleration due to gravity, g, is 9.8. Okay, what is the corresponding value of g in this rotating space station? And how does it depend upon the radius of the space station and the rate at which it's rotating? Okay, we're going to need this relationship. So what is g inside the space station? How is it related to the, what is it? Well, that was fast. Okay, v squared over r. So that's the center-directed acceleration, which is v squared over r. Okay. Now let's bring in the idea of omega in there, the rotation rate. Okay. So what we've got is this guy is rotating at some rotation rate omega, and omega is defined as 2 pi divided by the period. Okay, how long it takes to come around. So the shorter time it takes to come around, as t gets the period gets smaller, the rotation rate omega gets larger. Okay? So that's the relationship between those variables. And there's a radius r here, and there's a tangential velocity v. So what's the relationship here? So the velocity is distance over time. So in one period, what is the distance that a point on the outside covers? 2 pi r, that's distance, divided by time. How much time is it? T. And t, when we express it in terms of omega, is what? 2 pi over omega. Okay, so the 2 pi's cancel and we get r omega. Let's write it as omega r. Okay, so the tangential speed of Bob in that space station is the rotation rate, the frequency of rotation omega, times the radius. Okay, so for a given frequency of rotation, if we double the radius, we double the speed. Okay? So if we're, say, if Bob is here, his speed is that. If we doubled the radius, his speed would also double, obviously. Okay? Right. So that's that. So that tells us, what does that tell us? That tells us that g is equal to v squared divided by r. Well, here's v. If I square that, I get omega squared r squared divided by r is omega squared r. Okay? So that's the effect of g in there, and we'll need that. So in fact, we'll use it right now. So let's, we know what v is. V is omega squared. Have I done that wrong? The acceleration is v squared over r. Oh, right, sorry. when I was just v. V is omega r. Okay. Let's plug omega r into here. So that's the square root of 1 minus omega squared r squared over c squared times delta TA. In fact, let's write it this way. Delta TB over delta TA, the ratio of the rates at which the clock in here goes compared to the clock out here, that ratio is given by this. Okay? Now, what happens if we, for a given radius of space station, what if we start spinning it faster and faster and faster? Eventually, this outside edge will be moving at what speed? Speed of light. Okay, so let's see. So when that happens, what happens to this? So suppose that omega approaches c divided by r. If omega is c divided by r, what is v? V is omega times r. If we crank up omega to c divided by r, what is v? Okay, so the tangential speed approaches the speed of light. Okay, and in that case, this ratio here goes to 0. If it goes 1 minus 1, it goes to 0. Okay, and so the time dilation then becomes actually an infinite ratio or a 0 ratio. Okay, so when a certain amount of time elapses for Alice, basically no time elapses for the Bobs. Okay, so we get that extreme case. All right, so next question. So what we notice is that when Bob is out here at the very edge of the space station, and Alice's are out here, his time is moving more slowly relative to Alice's clocks outside. Okay, now suppose that this is the center of the space station up here, and we've got some Alice standing here, right, in that there's a little doorway, a little hatch kind of thing. So Alice is an inertial observer. She's at rest with respect to the other Alices out here. Okay? And Bob is whipping around like this. And inside this space station, there's this ladder by which Bob enters the space station, climbs down the ladder, and climbs back out again. Okay, so now suppose that Bob climbs up the ladder a little bit. Okay, so here's Alice up there. Here is Bob. Bob has climbed up the ladder a little bit like this. And Bob on this side. Okay, and what do we need to know? So we need to know that this whole space station is rotating some rate omega. And there's a distance from the center of the space station to Bob, which is r. Okay? And so what we notice is that as Bob climbs up this ladder towards the center there, his tangential speed changes. Does it increase or decrease? It decreases. If I've got this thing whipping around like this with some rotation rate, the point at the end is going twice as fast as the point at the middle. Okay? So as he goes upwards, as he climbs up that ladder, his velocity decreases. It's large out here, gets smaller, gets smaller, gets smaller, gets smaller. Okay? So as his velocity decreases, the time dilation, this is the relative velocity between Bob and Alice, the time dilation decreases. Okay? So the slowing of time decreases. So the point here is as r decreases, so as Bob climbs up the ladder, so he climbs against the gravitational field, okay, we notice that there's less slowing of Bob's clock. Okay, less slowing means it's going faster. Okay, times move more quickly. Okay, until, of course, when Bob reaches Alice's location and he's at rest with respect to her, then his time moves at the same rate as Alice's. But anywhere down here, it's slower, and it gets faster and faster and faster as he moves up. Okay, so now the question is, so this is what special relativity, so let me just back up. We've got Bob in this artificial gravitational field. We're asking, does special relativity tell us anything about the nature of this artificial gravitational field, which may or may not be true for a real gravitational field? What special relativity is telling us about this artificial gravitational field is that time moves more slowly in a gravitational field. Okay, and if you climb against that gravitational field, time should start moving more quickly again. Okay, and so that's the question. Is this true of a real gravitational field? By real, I mean one due to masses, as opposed to just simply accelerations. Well, is it? If I have a clock here, if I have two clocks, side-by-side identical atomic clocks, and I put one up here for a day and take it back down, will they have the same reading? Which one will be ahead? The one that stays will be ahead?
The other one.
Yeah. The one that I put up here.
Yeah.
So it is a fact that in this gravitational field that we're standing in, which is due to the mass of the Earth, if I have these two clocks here side by side, if I put one clock up here and hold it up there for the day, time moves more quickly up here than it does down here. More time, more seconds will have elapsed on that clock. When I bring it back down again and compare them, this guy will be a few seconds ahead of this guy, or a few nanoseconds or whatever it is. Okay? So this is actually true. So the answer is a big yes. Okay? And where might this be useful in the real world? GPS, global positioning system. So in the global positioning system, we have We have the Earth here, and we have a bunch of satellites out here. We have very, very accurate atomic clocks in those satellites, and we have very, very accurate atomic clocks on the Earth. Okay? But the fact is that time itself moves at a slower rate on the surface of the Earth than it does out here. So we can say time at infinity moves at a certain rate. As we move closer and closer to a massive object, the time moves more and more slowly relative to the time at infinity. Okay? So, or just along this line over here, this clock moves more slowly than this clock. Okay? And you need to take that into account, or the GPS system doesn't work. Okay? And in fact, it's quite dramatic. If you didn't take that into account, the global positioning system would fail in about 2 minutes, in terms of in terms of getting military accuracy. Okay, so this is actually true. I had some actually math down here. I'm not sure we're gonna. Let's not do that. Let's not do this math. Okay, let's just leave that. I can tell you about it later if you want. Okay, so that's fantastic, right? We've just looked at this artificial gravitational field in the context of special relativity, and we've discovered something about real gravitational fields. Okay? And then we test that idea, and yes, in fact, it's true. So this is an extremely well-tested, super high-precision test, and it is, in fact, true. And this is called the warping of time, the gravitational warping of time. Okay. What about length contraction? That was the other big and interesting effect in special relativity. Okay, so we've looked at time dilation. Sauce discovered something interesting. Length contraction. So here's the situation. Here's our rotating space station, top view, looking down the axis. And let's suppose that we start with it not rotating. Okay? And what we've got in this space station is not just one bob, we've got a bunch of bobs. Okay? In fact, we've got 100 bobs. Okay? So we've got 100 bobs. And each bob is of width 1 meter. Okay? Does that seem realistic? What's 1 meter? Okay, these bobs are like big football bobs. Okay? So we got 100 bobs. And they're each 1 meter in width, like this. And that's a bob. There's another bob. And these bobs are shoulder to shoulder, which means that the inside circumference of the space station is 100 meters. Okay? There's no gaps here. But if I draw no gaps, then it will look like one continuous line. Okay? And similarly, there's 100 Alices out here. The Alices are also big football Alices. They're also 1 meter. Okay? So the bobs are pressed right up against the wall of the inside of the spacecraft, of the space station, and the Alices are also very, very close to the wall. Okay? So basically, we can fit 100 1 meter Alices around like this. So there's one bob for every Alice. Isn't that nice? Okay. So there we go. Yeah, I didn't hear that. Okay, so okay, now we're going to make this guy rotate. Okay, we're going to see what happens. Okay, so first of all, nothing happens to the Alices. Okay, so the Alices are still shoulder to shoulder, 100 of them out here. Okay, and let me draw them a little bit further away so that they can reach their arms in. Okay, so we've still got the 100 Alices around like that. Okay, and we've got these bobs in here who are now in motion relative to the Alices. So now we've got a situation like this where we've got what happened to that stick?
There it is.
Okay. So here is a bob. Here's an Alice. I'm an Alice. Here's a bob drifting past an Alice like this. And what happens is, at one instant of time, so there's a light signal which is sent radiating outwards in all directions from the center. And the instant that these Alices receive that light signal, what they do is they reach out their arms and they measure the width of the bob that happens to be whipping by them at that moment. Okay? So here's a bob whipping by a particular Alice. She receives the light signal. Well, time to measure the width of the bob in front of me. So what she does is, well, I can't hold on to that thing at the same time. Anyways, this thing is going like this, and she goes chunk like this. So she puts both of her hands, she touches the bob in front of her, she touches both of his shoulders simultaneously, as far as she is concerned. Dunk, dunk, like this. Okay? And that is the width, the physical width that bob occupies in her space. Okay? And now, of course, we know from length contraction that physical width is less. Okay, so when the space station is not rotating, then all the bobs are exactly 1 meter. Okay, when the space station is rotating, Alice will find that she needs to put her hands maybe this close together, and then she can go chunk and touch both of Bob's shoulders simultaneously. Okay, and then she pulls them back and says, yes, that bob. And then what about the neighboring one? Here's a neighboring Alice, measures the neighboring bob in front of her. Oh, it's only this wide. And then the neighboring one measures this bob. Well, he's only this wide. Okay, and so all of the bobs are narrower. Okay, so Alice reaches into this moving bob space, and her hands, instead of being like just straight out like that, her hands have to be held inwards like this. Okay, and the bob that she measures is only that wide. Her hands go in like this to that rotating space station, and we have a narrower bob. Hands go in, narrower bob. Okay? All right. So that's the situation. So, does that seem odd to you? Why do gaps form? So, there are gaps here. There are gaps between the bob's shoulders. So what does that mean? What does that mean that the bobs see? Well, what the bobs must be seeing is when they start out at rest, space station not rotating, they're all tight shoulder to shoulder like this. As the space station starts spinning up, they feel a couple of things. One thing they feel is, or they notice a couple of things. One thing they is that they feel this artificial gravitational field, you know, pushing them to the floor or to the back or whatever. And at the same time, they notice that, whoa, there's gaps forming from one bob to the next. Okay, I feel exactly the same. I feel like, you know, I'm still the same height. I'm still the same width. I mean, everything's perfectly normal. I'm in this really strong gravitational field, artificial gravitational field. But nevertheless, I have the same dimensions as I usually do. And look, whoa, there's space getting between us. Okay, and so what the bobs say is when the space station is not rotating, they say that the inside circumference is 100 meters. Okay, now that it's rotating, they say this is 1 meter here. I'm still 1 meter, and I'm still 1 meter, and so on. But then there's these gaps. And so the inside circumference that's the co-rotating is greater. Greater than 100 meters, okay? So let's actually just write this down here. So, you know, when the space station was not rotating, it was maybe 100, it was a 100 meter jog around the inside. Okay, now that it's rotating really, really fast, the bobs are also rotating with the space station, and they find that it's maybe now a 200 meter jog around. Okay, and as we approach, as the outside edge approaches the speed of light, that outside circumference can become arbitrarily large. Okay, it can be a kilometer jog. You know, 10 kilometers, and so on. Yep. So one thing is that clearly, and the space station itself is rotating. Okay. So what you've started with is say a million atoms of metal are required to go around the outside edge of the space station. Okay, when it's not rotating. When it's rotating, the inside circumference, the co-rotating circumference, has become bigger, okay, due to this length contraction effect. Okay, and so that means that you're asking those 1 million atoms to stretch not over 100 meters as they used to do, but over now 200 meters or 500 meters. And so what's going to happen, what is going to happen to the metal skin of that space station?
It's going to break.
It's going to break. Okay, it's like an elastic and you're stretching it like this. And it's either going to stretch, it'll stretch until it breaks. Okay, so what you're going to have to do is, in order to make this space station work, is you're going to have to allow for breaks to happen and then weld in new pieces of metal. Okay, and then it keeps rotating faster and faster and faster. New breaks appear, you weld in new pieces of metal. Or you just make it out of a flexible material that's going to allow it to stretch like that. Okay? And in fact, so there's physically more volume inside this thing. Okay, so here's the space station here. Okay, if we start with this space station filled with, say, 1,000 buckets of water or something, it's all filled up all the way. If we start the whole thing rotating, the metal skin of the spaceship, as well as the space station, as well as the water itself. Okay, so if the water and everything is rotating really, really fast, then more space is inside. So for the Alices outside, the Alices see that this space station still occupies the same amount of space. It's still the same height, it's still the same radius, it's still the same everything. They just see this really fast spinning thing, but according to them, it occupies the same volume of space. Okay, but for people inside who are co-rotating with this thing, okay, their volume is larger. Okay, and so as it spins up, there's more volume, there's more elbow room. You could fit more stuff inside. You could fit more water inside. So Alice could sit at the top here and pour more and more buckets in. It started with 1,000 buckets, and then it gets more and more. And in fact, if the outside edge is moving at the speed of light, then you can show that the amount of volume increases exactly double. Okay, it's a simple mathematical calculation. If you know how to do integral calculus, you can show that.
So the
co-rotating space inside here is actually bigger. There's really more volume, more stuff. Like really.
Why?
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
Yeah, the pressure of the water would be large. So I'm imagining that this water is incompressible. Okay, but sure, the pressure would be large because you're taking some water and you're whipping it around really fast. Okay, so yeah, it would be under high pressure. And Bob, like imagine this though. I mean, like imagine the forces involved here though. We're talking about this guy, in that amusement park ride. You're going at like 3 or 4 meters per second, right? And you're feeling it already, right? These people in these G tests, where they test G-force, their ability to withstand G-forces and stuff, it's only like a few meters per second. If you crank this thing up to the speed of light, the artificial gravitational field is so strong that you will be instantly flattened to like, you know, pancake atom thick. Okay, you'll be like, you know, a tomato just splat. Okay, so very, very strong gravitational field. But anyways, so there you go. And so what we could say, just putting some figures in here, we could say that L, big L, is, say, the proper width of Bob. So that's the width that a Bob at rest with respect to himself measures. Okay, and that's the same as the proper width of Alice, which is the 1 meter that we were talking about there. Okay, let little L be the moving width. The moving width of a Bob. So what's the relationship between little L and big L? Did we actually write that down the other day, or did we just do it qualitatively? What's the relationship? Little L is equal to what times big L? Yeah. So it's the same. It's the same factor. Okay, so as the speed of light, as this tangential speed approaches the speed of light, the width of the moving bobs goes to zero. Okay, and so the picture then looks like this. You've still got your Alices, who are 1 meter, but they have to reach in like this, and these bobs are like microscopic. These bobs are like, they're paper thin. Okay, and there's gaps huge gaps in between. Like giant gaps, because if this is a Bob, And that's another bob, and they're very, very tiny. This distance is many, many bobs. It's many, many meters. Okay, so this could be like 10 kilometers inside. You reach into this co-rotating, this moving space, and there's 10 kilometers of space in there. It's really freaky. Okay, and R is not affected. This the radius is not affected by this. Okay, so now comes the question: how does this affect geometry? Clearly, something wacky is going to happen with the geometry. So let's look at that a little bit. Yep.
How can the R not be affected?
How can what?
How can the R not be affected
if
the outside is extended?
Because if it gets bigger, doesn't it have to actually get bigger? How does this work? Yeah. It doesn't even make.
Well, the R is unaffected because so when we're doing length contraction, suppose I have an object like this box here, okay? And this box is moving in this direction like this, okay? So it has no motion in that direction or that direction, so I won't see any length contraction in that direction or that direction. Like if I'm looking at this box coming at me like this, I will take my ruler out and I'll measure, yes, that's still 7 centimeters and that's still 5 centimeters. Okay, the only component of this box that's length contracted is the component in the direction of motion. So I'll see this box as the same surface area here, the same shape here, it'll just get like thin this way because it's moving that way. Okay, so for the bobs in this situation, it's only the dimension of the bobs. So if that's a bob, well, let's draw it a bit bigger. So if this is a top view of a bob, there's his head, and those are his shoulders. Okay, then what we will see is a contraction because the relative motion is this way to the right. What we'll see is a contraction along that axis. And so what Alice will see is a no contraction along this axis. Okay, so what Alice will see is a bob that has the same depth. So she will see that kind of a bob. So his face will be really like thin.
I know.
And
another question.
Yeah.
Why don't the actual walls contract in the direction of motion? Like the actual wall is moving faster, so shouldn't it also contract?
But the walls couldn't contract because. So I mean, what we have outside here is still 100 Alice's. There's still it's still 100 meters outside here. So the walls to contract, it would mean that the entire space station would become smaller, would move inwards like this.
Because like every, like because you know how like the motion would be like tangential to the circle, so would like each section of the wall compress maybe, like, I don't know, I guess.
Yeah, I mean one way to think about this is. Yeah. See, the problem is, suppose that each one of these sections, as you're saying, were to compress, okay? Then what that would mean is the Alice's say, okay, so these sections, when it's not rotating, are 1 meter, and then when the space station starts rotating, then these sections compress like this. And if that's going to happen, then the entire space station has to become smaller. So actually, this was this is a very good question, and this was raised by Ehrenfest. It's called Ehrenfest paradox, and so he had a real problem similar to that. Okay, and yeah, I'm not sure. So that's not helping, is it? maybe think about it this way. Let's look at those atoms again. Okay, so what we've got is a whole bunch of atoms, a million atoms strung around in a big string like that. So we have this million atoms which are stretching over 100 meters like this. And what we need is these 100 atoms. We're not changing the number of atoms. We still have a million atoms going around, whether it's rotating or not, right? So now what we're saying is these million atoms here, there still has to be a million atoms. However, each atom needs to be contracted. It's like each one of these guys needs to be contracted. Okay? So I guess maybe here's a way to say it. Yes, okay, so it is true that so we've got these 1 meter sized panels like this. Okay, now this thing starts rotating. And so yes, these 1 meter panels, if you want them to maintain their same size, so to speak, to not be stretched, then yes, these 1 meter panels should all shrink. And so what happens is gaps form like this. Okay? And then in order to keep the spaceship whole, you have to weld in new pieces of metal. Okay? And then so what that's saying is that the actual distance is increasing. Maybe that's the way to say that. Okay, yes.
Well, my question is that. So yeah, if you did fill those gaps with new pieces of metal you weld in, when it slows down again, what's gonna happen to that? Overall,
exactly. So what's going to happen is the thing is just going to, you're going to try to force more atoms into a space that they can't fit in. It's just going to buckle out. So in the same way that this water, right, you started with 1,000 buckets of water in here, spinning this, then you start spinning this thing up, more space appears, you put in 2,000 buckets. You've got 1,000 extra buckets in there. If you suddenly bring the water on the space station to rest, then those extra 1,000 buckets just explode the space station. So you have to build this thing out of flexible material, okay? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the geometry. Okay. Okay, so the geometry is something like this. In the co-rotating space, the circumference of a circle of radius r is, if it's not rotating, it's just 2 pi r. What if it's rotating? By what factor does it increase? What factor do you think? What's the length contraction factor?
The square root of 1 minus d squared.
Right. Okay, so it's going to be 2 pi r divided by the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. But v we know is omega r, so that's omega squared r squared over c squared. Okay, so the circumference is 2 pi r with this correction factor, and this correction factor gets bigger and bigger as the rotation rate increases, or as your radius increases. Okay, so what that's saying is something like this. Imagine that, so now we're talking about a little platform that sits in the middle here, and the bobs are standing on that platform. The platform and the bobs are all rotating. This is a rotating space relative to the outside. Okay, so in that rotating space, in that co-rotating space, the bobs have meter sticks and they're drawing triangles and they're trying to make straight lines and so on. They're trying to do geometry on the floor here. Okay, so they're gonna be drawing triangles and stuff. Okay, so if this space station is not rotating, the space is flat. Okay, and what we know about a flat space is if we draw a circle like this, then we know that there's a relationship between the circumference of the circle and the radius. And that's just circumference is 2 pi r. Okay? We also know stuff about the geometry. If we draw any triangle in that surface, what is the sum of the interior angles? 180. Or pi. Okay? So now let's look at the situation. Let's look at different kinds of geometry. Here's a different kind of geometry. We're going to consider two different kinds of geometry. Okay, one kind of geometry is instead of a flat surface, let's have a surface that is the surface of a sphere is a good example. Okay, so just need some room here. Okay, so suppose that, how did we draw this circle to begin with? We started at one point like this. One way to do it is we start at the center, we pick a point, we move radially outwards some distance, 10 meters, and then we put a little mark on the ground. Then we start at the center again, pick a different direction, move outwards 10 meters, stick a mark on the ground, and so on. Okay, and then we connect the dots. That's our circle. We're going to do the same thing on the surface of this sphere. We're starting at the North Pole. We're going to walk in a straight line, say 10 kilometers, put a mark on the ground. Walk in a straight line 10 kilometers, put a mark in the ground, and so on. And then we're going to connect the dots, and we're going to get a circle. Okay, so R is our 10 kilometers that we've walked, and C is the circumference. Okay, so the relationship between C and 2 pi R, is C greater than 2 pi R or less than 2 pi R? Less. Okay, so there's two ways to see this. Either you can say, I've walked this radial distance out like this, and I find that my circumference is less than I expected. Or you start on this circumference, you walk around that circumference, and you say, yeah, it's 100 kilometers around that circumference. I would expect, if space were flat, that I could get to the center by moving a certain distance, by walking a certain distance. But you would find, because of the curvature of the space, that you actually have to walk farther than you expected. Okay? You might have expected to only walk that distance, but because of this hump here, you have to cover more space. Okay, so this is called positive curvature, a space of positive curvature. Is that the kind of curvature that we have here? So here we have a situation where the circumference in the co-rotating space, we had the circumference was bigger than we expected at a given radius. Here we've got circumference less, so it's the opposite. So the other kind of geometry has a negative curvature. Okay, it's the surface of a saddle. So along the top here, it bends this way, and along the sides, it bends that way. Okay. So now I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to pick a point. I'm going to walk some distance r along this surface, put a little flag in the ground, walk some distance r, and so on and so forth. Okay, and then I connect the dots, and the kind of circle that I get comes up like this and looks like that. Okay, now in this circle, the relationship between C and 2 pi r is what? C is bigger or less than? It's bigger, because if you look at this picture here, what we've got is, let's start down over here. Okay, to walk around this circumference here, I have to go over this big hump here, and then back down into that valley, and then over that big hump, and then back down into that valley. Okay, so I'm covering a lot more circumference for a given radius. Okay, so this is called negative curvature. Okay, so we conclude that the kind of geometry, well, I guess we can't conclude that exactly, but the fact is that the kind of geometry inside is negative curvature. So the geometry that our bobs on this surface measure is negative curvature. Okay. So the whole point, remember, of all these bobs are experiencing an artificial gravitational field, and associated with that artificial gravitational field is some weird effects on the geometry. Okay, so maybe a real gravitational field also has similar effects, and the answer and the fact is that is true. Let me just show you. I'm just going to pop this up here. Hello, wake up. Okay, I want you to get a sense of how these gaps come about. Because now we have, we've talked about special relativity sufficiently. We talked about relativity of simultaneity and so on, that I could actually draw a picture which might make some sense to you. Okay, so here's what the picture looks like of the bobs inside that space station. And maybe let me just preface this picture with okay, so here we've got some bobs who are rotating around like this. So in terms of a space-time diagram, okay, we drew this picture here a little bit before. So here's a given bob, which starts at this location. But as time goes on, Bob is rotating around. Okay, and so the shape of his world line is a spiral up like that. And the shape of the neighboring Bob's World line is also a spiral up like that, beside that one, and so on. So we've got a bunch of spirals going up like that, all along a cylinder like this. Okay. So what we're doing here is we're saying, well, this kind of picture is hard to draw. So what we're going to do is we're going to take that cylinder. This is time, and we're going to take that cylinder and we're going to cut it like this, and then we're going to open it up. And if we do that, what we're going to have is a picture that looks something like this. We're going to have, this is the distance around a circumference from the outside, from Alice's perspective. Okay, so here's the space station. Here are the Alices out here. And here is a circumference around. And there are Bobs in that circumference. Okay? And so what Alice sees is these, as time goes on, she sees these Bobs moving to the right. And so she sees this. Okay. And so, and the Bobs themselves, what are the Bobs? Okay, sorry, let me back up. What are the Alices? So we had Alices outside here who were all 1 meter in length. Okay, so here are the Alices outside here. They're all exactly 1 meter in length. All shoulder to shoulder, okay? And the Bobs, when they're at rest, they're also 1 meter in length, okay? But now the Bobs, when they're moving, we know that the Bobs themselves will be tilted in time relative to the Alices. Okay, so the Bobs' x-axis looks like this. The Bobs themselves look like this relative to the Alices. Remember, this is Bob's time axis. This is Bob's space axis. Bob is on his space axis. His space axis goes from shoulder to shoulder, goes through his shoulders. Okay? And so that's Bob's space axis, and that's Bob. Okay? So in this picture here, let's turn on the light here. Let's see if that comes on. Okay. Yeah. So just roughly, I'm not going to go through the details of this. I'm just going to just show you a couple of things about this. So these are, this is one Alice next to another Alice and so on. And this is Bob's left shoulder, the world line of his left shoulder. This is the world line of Bob's right shoulder, just like that. And Bob himself, from shoulder to shoulder, is tilted in time relative to Alice. Okay? So this distance here is 1 meter. Okay? Now the distance, the width of the Bobs, as seen by the Alices, well, what is that? That's less than 1 meter. The width of the Bobs, as seen by the Alices, is this. This is Bob's left shoulder. This is Bob's right shoulder. When Alice reaches in and touches both shoulders simultaneously, she's touching the right shoulder and the left shoulder simultaneously. Okay? And what she finds is his left shoulder might be aligned with her left shoulder, but his right shoulder is here, which is a little bit less distance than her right shoulder. Okay, so she finds that the gap between the Bobs, as seen from the outside, is this little distance over here. Okay, and if you work it out, this example is worked out for half the speed of light. If the tangential speed is half the speed of light, then we see this gap here. And if you work out the contraction factor, the gap, the width of the Bobs should be root 3 over 2, which is about 0.86, 0.87, compared to 1. So this is how wide Alice sees the Bob to be, and this is how wide she sees herself to be. And this is the gap, then. This distance minus this distance is 1 minus root 3 over 2. That's the gap she sees between the Bob's shoulders from the outside. What about the gap that the Bob sees inside? So Bob here, he's 1 meter long. The gap that he sees, this is his right shoulder, and this is the neighboring Bob's left shoulder. This is Bob's x-axis here. That distance is the gap that he sees. And you can work it out. I don't want to get into details. You can work it out. It's basically this gap distance here, 1 minus root 3 over 2, divided by root 3 over 2, so that the total distance from here to here, length contracted, produces 1 meter. So I'll make a copy of this thing, and you can stare at it and try to make sense of it. All right? It's a great exercise. But anyways, I just want to show you that you really can do this. This is really true. Okay? There's all kinds of fascinating things associated with this. More about time and so on. The bobs inside cannot synchronize their clocks, and it's a really fascinating situation. Anyways, so at the end of the day, let me just say a couple words about the geometry. And then talk a little bit about similar effects in a real gravitational field produced by masses. Okay, so the kind of geometry, just very, very quickly here, on a flat surface, some of the angles inside of a triangle is 180. If I draw a triangle on the surface of a sphere, some of the interior angles is what, bigger or less than 180? Bigger than 180. If I draw a triangle on the surface of a satellite like this, my triangle will look like that. Okay, so these are straight lines. Okay, this is if I walk on the surface of this triangle, shuffling my feet parallel to each other like this, I will walk along a line like this. If I start in that direction, I will end up going over there. If I start in that direction, I end up going over there. The sum of such triangles made up of straight lines, some of the interior angles is now less than 180. This is the kind of geometry we have inside that the bobs experience, the co-rotating bobs experience. Okay, and so in other words, they would draw triangles that look like this for Alice's. Alice is looking down, taking a snapshot of the triangles that Bob have drawn. The triangles would look like this. Okay? That sort of thing. But for Bob, these triangles, these are all straight lines. Okay, let me just talk a little bit about straight lines. So this is a fact which I will try to motivate. If the outside edge of the disk that the Bobs are measuring their geometry on is moving at the speed of light, then straight lines, according to Bob, in other words, lines of the shortest distance between any two points, look like this. They are all of the form of circles that intersect the outside edge at right angles. So pick any circle, both of whose intersection points intersect at right angles. That's a straight line for Bob. Okay, so here's another straight line for Bob. That's a straight line. Okay, and here's another straight line. Okay, so if the bobs, the co-rotating bobs inside this rotating platform, one is standing over here at that edge and one is standing at that edge, and they want to connect themselves with a string. So they got a string connecting each other and they pull tight. Okay, so they minimize the distance between each other. That string would occupy this, these points. Okay, when Alice looks down, she would say, oh yeah, that's a curved string. Bob would say, no, that's straight. Okay, so their geometry is warped like that. So you can get an intuitive feel as to why that's the case, because you might be thinking, well, no. That's a straight line. This is the shortest distance between that point and that point. But not for the co-rotating bobs, because remember, for the co-rotating bobs, what used to be a 100-meter jog around the outside is now 10 kilometers. Okay, so their space inside is warped, okay, is larger. Okay. But that effect, and that effect grows as you go further out. So the effect is most extreme over here, and it gets less extreme over here. Okay, near the center, it's rotating very, very slowly, and the space is basically flat. Okay, it gets extremely warped near the edges. So basically what we're saying is, if you take this path, if you draw this path over here looks like it's shorter, but in fact, it's passing through a region of space which is significantly more warped than this region of space. There's a lot more. There's like maybe 20 kilometers from there to there. There's maybe only 10 meters from there to there. It gets rapidly more warped this way. So to get to the shortest distance from there to there may very well be this path here, because so although you're it looks like it's curved, you're moving through a region of space that's less warped. Okay, so this is in fact, this is shorter than that. Okay, and so this is in fact the straight line for the bobs inside that That's the kind of geometry that they have. Okay, and there are similar effects for real gravitational fields, completely analogous effects. Okay, and so here's a simple example. And Michael will be talking a lot, will be drawing pictures like this, I'm sure, when he's talking about black holes. So we have a geometry like this. So what is that geometry? You all have seen a picture like this, right? What does that picture mean? Well, it means if I have a sphere like this, if I have a star like this, and I'm interested in the geometry of the space that slices through the equator, okay, so there's a slice of space passing through the equator, and I'm sitting in this space, and I'm making measurements. I'm drawing triangles. I'm sending light signals from there to there. I'm looking at angles, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? That geometry, it turns out, is such that if you were to draw a circle, if you were to walk around in a big circle like this and say, oh, yeah, that's 10,000 kilometers around that particular circumference, given that this is 10,000 kilometers, I might expect that if I move radially inwards, there's some distance involved. If it's a flat surface, I could guess what that is. But what you will find is that the distance that you have to walk radially inwards is more than you expect. There's simply more space on that surface than you expect. And so the way that's drawn is, the way you represent that idea is, you say, here's my circumference over here. Okay, it's a million kilometers or whatever. To get to the center, it's not like on a flat surface where the distance is this. Somehow I need to represent that I need to walk further. And the way you do that is you just bend the surface down like this. Okay, so walking towards the center is just sort of abstractly represented as going down this hill here, going down into this valley. And so you have to cover more distance. Okay, so that's what these diagrams mean. It's important that this diagram doesn't have to be drawn, that hump doesn't have to be drawn going down. That hump could equally well be just drawn as a hill like that. The idea is that you go around a circumference, and to walk toward the center, you have to go further than you expect. And so you just abstractly represent it as a hill like that. Okay? And that's precisely the kind of geometry that the sun has. Okay? I guess a couple of years ago, the Cassini mission to Saturn provided a very, very precise measurement of that. There were other measurements before, but this was really precise. So they had the Cassini over here, spacecraft, the Earth over here, sending a light signal past the sun like this. And that light signal, the delay from here to here was longer than expected. If the space were flat, there would be a certain delay. The delay was longer, and the delay was longer because here's Cassini, here's Earth, okay? That light signal has to go not just the ordinary distance, but it has to cover a greater distance, go down into this valley and then back out again. Had to cover a greater distance, took more time. And the measurements exactly agreed with what general relativity predicts about the warping of space. So anyways, at the end of the day, the lesson here is that in special relativity, by considering accelerated observers, in this case, people experiencing centripetal or center-directed acceleration, Einstein was able to get a hint that maybe real gravity has something to do with warping of space and time. Okay? And then, of course, he took those ideas much further and provided a full mathematical formulation, and you get general relativity. Let me just emphasize that in this entire picture, there is no space-time is not warped. It's all flat space-time. Okay, it's just Bob accelerated in flat space-time. But space becomes warped, okay, and time itself becomes warped. But space-time is still flat. To get real gravitational fields, you want space-time to curve. And that's what Michael is going to be talking about. Okay, so that's it. Take a break.